Masonry foundations and water are usually a bad combination, but when salt gets into the mix, things can get downright nasty. Why is this, and what can you do about it?
Welcome to GBA Radio.
This podcast series is excerpted from a two-day seminar on building science fundamentals taught by Dr. Joe Stiebrick and Dr. John Straub of Building Science Corporation. For information on attending a live class, go to buildingscienceseminars.com. In our last episode, Dr. Joe Stieber compared air barriers and vapor barriers and explained how air tightness helps keep homes free of mold and rot. This week, Dr. Joe explains how water and salt move through masonry by osmosis, often causing serious damage to foundations.
It's not effervescence, it's efflorescence. Effervescence is with Pepsodent, and you use it to clean dentures. So this is the problem that we're trying to deal with. In new construction, it's real easy, right? You go to the top of the footing, you've got your stone break, you've got your damp proofing. You don't have to worry about salt. You don't have to worry about capillarity. Life is good. It's kind of hard to retrofit this. It's a wonderful way of doing it in new construction, but obviously it's tough if you've got 100 or 200 or 300 year structure to deal with. All right. The physics of the osmosis forces are water takes the salt in solution to a surface, the water evaporates. The salt is left behind, and as more water evaporates, more salt accumulates, so the concentration of salt goes up. Well, as the concentration of salt goes up, water rushes to the concentration of salt in order to dilute it. Because one of the rules of physics is that nature doesn't like these concentrations, and they want to have a uniform concentration. And to prevent a concentration from occurring, you want to dilute it. The water rushes to dilute this. The action of the water rushing to the surface actually creates hydrostatic forces. The hydrostatic pressures developed as a result of the water rushing through the pore system to dilute the concentration of salt causes the material to flake apart. And the explosive flaking is referred to as spalling. So spalling occurs as a result of the hydrostatic pressures developed in the water rushing to dilute the salt concentration that occurred because of the migration of the water carrying salt in solution to a surface where the water evaporates. Whew. Let me summarize this. Salt is very bad. Repeat after me. Salt is very bad. Let me now give you the second piece. Water is very bad. Repeat after me. Water is very bad. Salt and water together, whoa. We call that a Barry Bonds problem. Stupid on steroids. The pressures are extraordinary. Vapor diffusion, vapor pressures, 3 to 5 PSI, they're nothing. Water vapor never push nothing off of nothing. Nothing. Capillary pressures, they're fairly impressive, 300 to 500 PSI, moves water to the top of a 400-foot tree. That's a pretty impressive force, but it isn't in anywhere close to the league of osmosis pressures, which are 3 to 5,000 PSI. The compressive strength of even good concrete is 2 to 3,000 PSI. Salt will beat concrete. Salt and water win. Osmosis beats capillarity, which beats diffusion. Wow. It's, bridges fall down. Life comes to an end when you have salt and water. Well, old timers figured stuff out. Capillary water in the basements would evaporate to the inside, leaving the salts behind. The damage would occur very close to the slab, or it wouldn't occur up high, it would occur to the water source. Well, what these folks noticed was that the mortar was eaten away at a much faster rate than the masonry. And certain mortars were eaten away a lot faster than other mortars. The porosity, the pore structure of the mortar was very critical. And somebody said, aha, if I get the pore structure of the mortar just right, maybe all of the salt will end up in the mortar and not in the brick. And maybe the mortar can sacrifice itself to protect the integrity of the brick. And that was where we figured out that softer and weaker mortars with very tiny pore structures are actually the ideal complement to a clay brick that was fired to the right temperature, so that the water and salt would end up in the mortar, not in the brick. And over time, the mortar would be eaten away. And the solution would therefore be to repoint the mortar in the joints. And hence, that was this whole basis of preserving these masonry buildings. The idea was that we're going to always repoint with a mortar that's softer and weaker than the brick or the masonry itself, so that the mortar sacrifices itself to protect the structure. You never want to have a mortar that's stronger than the brick, because then the brick sacrifices itself to protect the mortar. That's why historic preservationists, the old ones, the ones that know stuff because they've been around a long time, go to an enormous amount of trouble in old buildings to match the mortar chemistry precisely. The general rule is, if you don't know what's going on, don't f with the building. Or if something's been around for 200 or 300 years, don't f with the strategy. So if we have a successful strategy, meaning some old mason, engineer, master builder figured it out and it's been around that long, you absolutely want to make the mortar be no better than what you have. In fact, you're better off having it softer or weaker. This is a very difficult concept to basically give to youngsters, young engineers and young architects who don't appreciate the fact that things actually last longer if they're in fact weaker. It's very much a Zen kind of a thing as opposed to trying to make it as powerful as possible. I can't tell you how many buildings we've seen, you know, structural engineers and young consultants say you should add polymer modification to the mortar and have a very, very low water to cement ratio because we want a very strong and powerful mortar. And the answer is no, we want a very weak, we want a very soft mortar, because that's what's going to ensure the longevity of this particular assembly. Anyway, with the right mix, all of the deterioration happens in the joints, and the joints get eaten away, and you simply repoint them on a 15 or 20 year basis. Well, this led to the next step, which is, well, why not just coat the whole darn thing with a sacrificial layer, and instead of doing this on a 10-year basis, maybe extend it to a 30 or 40-year basis. And so this entire sacrificial layer, the way you think of it is, think of it as a lime-based poultice that sucks the salt poison out of the assembly. And so how do you know when you have to replace it? Well, when it falls off. It's the building telling you it's time to put on another sacrificial layer. This is pretty cool. Most of Europe is constantly being recoated and reparched with sacrificial layers. It's an incredibly sophisticated, extensive delivery mechanism for constantly rehabilitating mass structures that are hundreds of years old. Yeah. Pretty awesome. Now, the irony is that despite all of the European experience and knowledge with capillarity and osmosis and sacrificial layers, they don't prevent it. It's trivial to prevent the problem. They just have such a good infrastructure on repairing the problems, they somehow have forgotten how to avoid them in the first place. And so it leads to some comical situations. We do a fair bit of work in Europe. I won't tell you for who or for how, but it requires security clearances. And we often interface with European architects. And so they're not in the business of putting in capillary breaks, so they basically allow the capillarity to carry the salt, and they have this deterioration, and they just assume on a 20-year, 30-year time cycle, somebody's going to come in there and redo and repair it. And it's trivial to fix it, because all that we need to do at the construction stage is to what? Is to put in the capillary breaking materials. And so when I have these discussions with the European architects, they're like, A, they're stunned that somebody from the New World knows anything about capillarity. I explain the physics and the history. And then they say, ah, he's Czech. The Czechs always knew this. They can't give anybody in the New World a break. You know what I mean? They can't give us over here a break. But anyway, so the idea is if you build it into new construction, you don't actually have to worry about in the second or third generation, meaning when you're rehabilitating and changing this building in 100 years from now, right? Anyway, it's kind of fun dealing with them. Well, we've come up with some simple rules. If the wall is X thick, you want to have at least 1.5X between embedded joists and the grade to allow sufficient area for evaporation of the water into the sacrificial coating. Because if you don't have enough area, the moisture content of the joists will go up. And so how do we track our success? As you spot monitor the moisture content of the timber. You know you get into trouble when the moisture content of the timber begins to do what? Go up. You can smoosh it to 3/4 X if you reduce the area of migration with a reglet. You basically cut through 1/4 of the way and insert a stainless steel flashing. And you're basically throttling down the flow so that you still have dissipation, but you don't have enough of a concentration to deteriorate this. And this is just based on observation and trial error from my perspective over the last 25 years. You take a guess based on experience, and your feedback is, did it work? And the good news is that we have only several hundred years of this experience available to us to draw on. It's written in these things called books that are found in libraries, but they're very old books, which means you have to ask the librarian, which involves a social interaction, which is why structural engineers don't know about it.
Tune in next week when Dr. John Straub explains why we should care about how heat moves through our buildings.
GBA Radio is a production of greenbuildingadvisor.com. Thanks for listening.